Welcome to the Issue Is Bonus Extra podcast. This is where we get an opportunity to talk to some of our favorite panelists, get to know them, talk about the news, talk about what makes them them. And we've got one of the smartest minds in all of politics for the last 40 years. Bob Schrum is here. Bob Schrum is right now the co-director of the USC Center for the Political Future at the greatest university in the history of the world, but maybe I'm biased.
Fight on.
Fight on. He, of course, is a campaign veteran of so many different campaigns. Some of the people that he's worked with in the past include John Kerry, Ted Kennedy was one of his best friends, Richard Gephardt. He's worked on so many different iterations, the McGovern campaign. I mean, it goes back, right?
Well, that one, you know, we lost 49 states, and I was a kid writing speeches, and I've often said that maybe the reason that we lost 49 states was that we were kind of young. I mean, the pollster was 21 years old.
Wow.
You know, I was 28. The campaign manager was like 34. So we were a children's crusade, and we had about the same result as the historic children's crusade did in Europe.
So now he's involved in a lot of different things, and he wrote about it years ago in a book called No Excuses, Concessions of a Serial Campaigner. We're going to talk about some of his background because there's so many great stories over the years, but we want to begin with sort of where the race is at right now. You have unique insight into the Democratic primary because you've been a part of so many Democratic primaries. Where do you see things?
I don't know that things have fundamentally changed after the first debates. I suspect that Biden may take a slight hit but will still be in the lead. If he takes a big hit, that means he's really in bad shape and vulnerable. But I think he'll take a slight hit and he'll have low expectations going into the next debate, which will help him. People who broke out, I think, in these two debates were Kamala Harris, for sure, Pete Buttigieg, who I thought did a terrific job, Elizabeth Warren. She was already in the top tier. I think she's bleeding support away from Bernie Sanders. And Julian Castro, by all accounts, had a good night. But you have to be very careful about writing people off. I mean, we've just been through too many of these contests where somebody starts at a certain level, they go down, people write them off, and then suddenly they come roaring back. I went through that with the Kerry campaign in 2003.
Well, and the thing about Biden is, of course, he comes into this with a big pad, right? He's got some votes he could potentially lose because he's got such a big lead right now.
Well, he's got I think very strong African American support, and I do think it would be very perilous for Kamala Harris to go down the road of attacking the Obama-Biden administration and going after Biden in terms of what that would do with African Americans. But most of all, he has, and we saw this in our most recent USC Dornsife LA Times poll, 86% of Democrats believe that he will definitely or probably defeat Donald Trump. That's way ahead of the number for anybody else.
But part of that mystique, I think, going into the debate was this reputation that he had for being a really strong debater and looking really tough in those past debates when we saw him against Paul Ryan and Sarah Palin and even against Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton back in the day. Last night, we saw Kamala Harris go after him with an aggressiveness, and it seemed like he was a little off. Or did he look... I'll just say it flat out. Did he look old to you?
It wasn't old. He wasn't sharp.
But if people are concerned about him being old, is that a problem?
Yeah, but I don't think it's the numerical age that matters. It's whether or not he's got the energy, the vision, the strength to stand up to Trump. And he can't afford a series of debate performances like last night. He's got to prepare. I don't really understand why he wasn't better prepared for the attack from Kamala Harris. It was a perfectly predictable attack, and he should have been able to handle it. So the real question here is, how does he perform at the end of July, which is the next debate, and then how does he perform in September? I think the debates then are September 11th and 12th or 12th and 13th. He's got pad, you're right, but he can't depend on that pad, and you can't rest on the pad. You got to keep fighting.
I mean, we did this focus group with undecided voters, and the 19-year-old kid that was here may have been the smartest one of all of them, and he made the point that, you know, Joe Biden hasn't been doing a lot of the group stuff. Like, we went to the California convention. He wasn't there. The New York Times asked all of them questions. He didn't do that. Like, a lot of these events and interviews and other things he hasn't done. Do you think he's a little rusty?
Well, I think the California convention charge is a little unfair. His granddaughter was graduating from school, and if I were him, I would have been there too. I would have been at the granddaughter's graduation.
He went to a human rights campaign.
He went to a human rights campaign fund event, and
in Ohio.
Yeah, it was something else he missed where he went to the graduation of his granddaughter. But I think the general point that he may be rusty is probably correct. You mentioned all the debates he had. The truth is, in the last 11 years, he's only had one debate. And that was against Paul Ryan.
Mm-hmm.
And he needs, I think, to prepare very intensely for this next series of debates.
So let's talk about you. Let's get into some of that, too. When did you know that you had the political bug? What do you have? Is there a
always,
particular moment?
Always. Yeah. I remember in grammar school asking my parents if I could stay home to hear Douglas MacArthur speak to the Congress after Harry Truman fired him as the U.S. commander in South Korea.
Hmm.
When I was a 9-year-old kid, I went and volunteered at the Stevenson headquarters in Culver City, California.
Hmm.
And they said, of course, I couldn't go door to door, but I could get on the phones and talk to people.
Did you use a lower voice?
Well,
that?
I was about to say, the only thing I had to get used to was people kept saying, yes, ma'am. And I had to not correct them. So I always cared about it. I always was involved in it. I, like a lot of people in my generation, I think, was tremendously inspired and motivated by John Kennedy. That inaugural address is still very much part of my DNA and how I think about the world. And then, you know, I got lucky. I got out of law school, and shortly afterwards got hired to be the speechwriter for Mayor John Lindsay in New York, ended up being McGovern's speechwriter in 1972. And, you know, students sometimes ask me, how do you duplicate this? And I say, I don't know. You got to have a lot of luck.
Mm.
You got to have somebody who's going to help you along the way.
What's the process like for writing a political speech for a presidential candidate? How does that actually work?
Well, it can be different for different candidates. I think, for example, with Ted Kennedy, we had a sufficient mind meld that he could sort of tell me what he wanted the speech to say. And I could also say, and I think we should say this, and we'd write a draft. And, yeah, we'd edit the draft, but it would be pretty much done. With others, it's a more complicated process. And especially when you're doing a major policy speech, you have all the policy input. But speeches tend, I think, most of these speeches, if they're effective, tend to be driven by political imperative. So I was helping President Clinton with the State of the Union message in 1998. And it was the week after the Monica Lewinsky scandal broke. And I had known him since college, and I had said to him, I wasn't on the White House staff, but I had said to him in the Oval Office, look, I know this is tough, but for the next week, you've really got to focus on this, because a week from now, people are going to decide whether you can still be president of the United States.
Mm.
And as we were going through editing the speech, and Clinton was amazing. He used to edit by standing in the White House theater looking at the teleprompter, and he would edit while he stood there.
What do you mean? So how would that
he'd say,
work?
Oh, let's take that out. Why don't we move this paragraph here? Why don't we phrase this way?
Mm.
And I was arguing that we should put a call for a minimum wage increase near the very front of the speech because we needed to get all the Democrats on their feet right away. And there were some of the policy people who were saying, no, it's not time for a minimum wage increase. We had one recently. We shouldn't be pushing for another one right away. And I said, look, all I know is I really do want those Democrats to get on their feet early because this speech is not just a test of policy. It's a test of your presidency.
Mm.
And Clinton said, put it in.
Mm.
So it different process with different people.
How did Bill Clinton compare to everybody else you've worked with?
Oh, he's one of the most naturally gifted politicians I've ever seen. He's actually a brilliant political strategist for himself. Not necessarily, by the way, for other people.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think he was terribly useful to Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2008, especially when he went after Obama after the South Carolina primary and provoked Ted Kennedy into endorsing Obama. I don't think he was a particularly useful strategist in 2016, although he was more on the mark, by the way, than some of the people in the Clinton campaign, because he kept saying, we have to go in to some of these downscale blue-collar areas, and we have to campaign harder there. It's amazing when you look at it, but Hillary Clinton, Lynn Vavreck at UCLA has come up with the number that the telling number. Only 9% of Clinton's ads in the 2016 campaign mentioned jobs and the economy. That's unthinkable for a Democratic candidate for president.
The other person you're probably most known for your work is with Ted Kennedy, who I think is one of your closest friends, right?
He was a very close friend, yeah.
How did you first get involved with him, especially as a kid that was so inspired by his brother? Was it sort of surreal to then come close with him?
Yes, it was, but then he becomes a real friend,
right?
And you know, you go sailing. The truth, we often would do things, but we go sailing and we talk about an issue or a debate or something that was coming up. And very early on, he tried to have everybody be part of the crew, and he yelled out some instruction to do something. I had no idea how to do it, and he then named me permanent passenger. And I never crewed again. Now, when I got married and my wife came up, and she would go with us, she used to sail a lot when she was a kid, so she became part of the crew. But he was a real, genuine, funny person. He was another naturally gifted politician. And he combined two things that you don't often see. He combined a high sense of principle and conviction. I mean, it was appropriate to call him the liberal lion of the Senate. But he was also one of the great deal makers of all time. So he'd go to Orrin Hatch after the failure of the Clinton health care plan and say, let's insure all the poor kids in America. And Hatch would say, well, I don't want a single federal program to do that. And he'd say, well, how about if we have a federal program, but we administer it through the states? And so they got together and they passed SCHIP, the CHIPS program, which insures millions of poor children in this country.
Still does.
Yeah. And he was really good at doing that. When he had to, he was good at taking people on. He and Ronald Reagan had a pretty good personal relationship. But when he came back from South Africa, and I went with him on that trip in the beginning of 1985, he was convinced that this idea of constructive engagement wasn't getting us anywhere and that we had to have sanctions on the apartheid regime. And ultimately, he signed on to it, and the Black Caucus had been for it all along, but he became a critical element of it. And ultimately, they overcame Reagan's veto and imposed sanctions on South Africa, and the apartheid regime fell.
Well, speaking of Reagan, let's go back to Carter versus Reagan and Carter versus Kennedy. This was, of course, 1979, 1980. There was a short time where you worked for Jimmy Carter for like 3 or 4 days, right?
Ten days. Don't shortchange me.
Okay, that's almost a full Scaramucci. It's Anthony Scaramucci at 11 days. He was not your guy.
Look, I think he's been, in many ways, an excellent ex-president. Mm-hmm. But he does remind me of Tacitus' line about a Roman emperor, all would have thought him fit to rule if he never had. He just was not a very successful president, and I think part of that was because while he has core personal religious convictions, I don't think he had a lot. He didn't come to the presidency with a lot of core convictions about public policy. I think he has more of them now.
So Ted Kennedy then decides to run against him, and then one of his most famous speeches, his speech at the 1980 convention, you wrote that speech.
I helped write it.
What was the thinking?
And the reason, by the way, that everybody knew I helped write it was because he told people. And he left the convention after the speech. I stayed because we had a deal with the Carter people on the platform. And in the cab on the way back to the hotel, where because he couldn't spend his own money under federal law, Kerry Parker, his L.A., and I were in one bedroom, and he and his wife were in another bedroom. We were sharing the suite. And when I got there, there was a little party going on, and I grabbed him and took him into the corner and said, look, I was in the taxi cab coming back, and they were talking about the speech, and they said something like, this terrific speech was written by Bob Schrum and Kerry Parker. And I said, how – I didn't say anything. I just want you to know. And he said, oh, I did. He said, because I came off the podium and somebody asked me who wrote the speech. And I knew if I didn't say that you guys wrote the speech, everybody else in the world would say they wrote the speech. Mm. So I just said, you guys did it. He always understood that giving people credit actually helped him. It didn't. He was not jealous of saying that somebody did something. And he would give away legislation in the Senate to other people if that would help to pass it.
But he didn't give a lot of credit to Jimmy Carter.
Well,
right, and they didn't raise up his arm.
Well,
right,
that's a whole other story. I mean, we left. The Carter people did not want us to leave for the convention hall during Carter's acceptance speech, obviously, during the demonstration after Mondale's acceptance speech, or during Mondale's speech. So it would have been like leave 3 hours in advance. But they said, no big problem, just leave as Carter finishes his speech. And there's going to be a lot of cheering, and the balloons are going to drop and all of that. Well, A, the balloons didn't drop. B, they overpacked the hall, so everybody was really hot. Mm. And C, the speech was not all that successful. Mm. And so we crawled across Manhattan in traffic, and we got there late. We had practiced raising Carter's hand. Mm. And as he was about to go onto the podium, I said, don't forget to raise his hand. And he got up there, and the people milling around, they were calling up the mayor of Norwalk, Connecticut. And, the hand just never got raised. And when he came back down, I said, what happened? He said, it just didn't feel right.
Wow. Do you think that Carter would have won re-election if Teddy hadn't challenged him?
No. First of all, the hostages in Iran, I believe, saved Carter in the primaries. Kennedy had a big lead. And suddenly the whole question became, for example, in Iowa, that a vote for Carter was a vote for the hostages and to stand up to the Ayatollah. So I think they helped him in the primaries up until the failure of the raid to attempt to rescue the hostages, at which point I think people began to get tired of the whole thing and say, wait a minute, he says he's in the White House, he's focused only on this, he's not campaigning, why aren't they freed? And then I think that in the fall, the hostages were part of a big, big problem for him, compounded by the situation in the economy. Given the condition of the economy, I think as long as Reagan reassured people that he was not going to take us to nuclear war, they were going to take a chance on him. That's the irony of 80, by the way, because the country was going to change, and it could have either moved in a progressive direction or a conservative direction. But when the only change option was to move in a conservative direction, that's where they went.
And then you were also involved in these sort of flashpoint elections about what country going in a different direction in both 2000 and 2004 when we were so close to potentially making a change. Why do you think, because I know we got to go soon, but just why do you think that Al Gore and John Kerry weren't able to get over the finish line, even though they were really close? I mean, Al Gore as close as anybody's ever been to the presidency versus somebody like a Barack Obama or even a Donald Trump. Were able to get over the finish line.
Well, first, I think Al Gore is the only person who's been elected but not inaugurated. I believe he carried Florida, and George Bush became president when the Supreme Court decided to act like a ward committee and by a vote of 5-4 awarded him the presidency. Kerry came as close as anyone in history, or maybe closer than anyone in history, to defeating an incumbent president renominated by his own party in time of war. Change about 30,000 or 40,000 votes in Ohio, and he's president of the United States. So those are the nights that break your heart. I mean, the Gore thing went on for 37 days.
Right.
I can remember we were in the Palm Restaurant in Washington. The Florida Supreme Court had ordered a recount of all the Florida ballots, every one of them. We were having a good dinner, and then suddenly our cell phones started pinging, and the Supreme Court had stayed the action of the Florida court. In 2008, beginning of the night, exit polls said we were going to win. Our people in Florida were pretty sure we were going to carry Florida. That slipped away. Then Ohio slipped away. Those are hard nights. And what makes it harder is because, like 2:30 in the morning or something, I'm on the phone with John, and he says, Can you draft a concession speech and be at the house at 9 in the morning? Mm. I mean, my job wasn't to write speeches anymore, but it was to write that speech.
Mm. And what goes through your mind? What's that process like?
I just walked back to my hotel with my wife and got some coffee and sat there and wrote it and got it typed up. You know, I can't type, so we have to get somebody to type it. And took it over to his place. And, I mean, at that point, it's not about you. It's about trying to help the candidate through this incredibly difficult moment where he came infinitely close to being president of the United States, and he's not.
Mm. I could talk to you for like 2 hours, but I want to ask one question as we wrap up about what you're doing now. USC Center for the Political Future, you're dealing with a lot of the smartest young people. You're trying to bring together people from both sides. You work with Mike Murphy at USC on this, bring together really smart people, try to find areas where we can actually not necessarily agree, but talk civilly about our disagreements, which is a different approach. You deal with a lot of young people now. What's your most important advice to people that are interested in politics or interested in this world that you impart?
Understand that you're going to have adversaries. They're not enemies. That if you lose the game, you're not supposed to burn down the stadium. That politics, as JFK once said, is an honorable profession. And my experience was that most of the people I worked for were honorable, here and overseas, and that they were in politics, sure, because they had an ego. But they also had convictions and beliefs, and they wanted to advance those beliefs.
Awesome. Thank you for the work that you do. Thank you for coming on our show. Thank you for blessing our show.
Thanks for the show. The show's great.
Thank you very much. That means a tremendous amount coming from you, because I know you've done them all. So it's nice to have you. Bob Schrum, ladies and gentlemen. And check out the work. You can see more on the website for the USC Center for the Political Future. So check out also the podcast version of the show Bob just did with Areva Martin, Caroline Heldman, and Ann Coulter as well. And we'll be back next week with more of The Issue Is. Thanks so much for listening.